Much has been written about the battle at Gettysburg, the great generals, the what-ifs of military tactics. But what about the battlefield after the fighting stopped?
Civilians find their wells contaminated. Soldiers have eaten their crops. They have ruined their fencing, this elaborate fence networks. They're going to struggle to regain any sense of normalcy for years to come.
Today on With Good Reason, not just the history of the battle, but the story of the Gettysburg battlefield. That's later in the show. But first, the National Endowment for the Humanities turns 50 this year, and their new chairman, Bro Adams, has launched a new initiative supporting public scholarship. Bro Adams joins me in the studio to talk about his background and the future of the National Endowment for the Humanities. I hear that your unusual name, Bro, actually was given to you as a nickname by your father.
That's right. My father, like many in his generation, left college early to enlist in the Army to fight in World War II. And he left Williams College with a friend named Bro. My father ended up fighting in Germany. I'm not sure where his friend ended up, but he ended up being killed. I was born in 1947. My father started to call me Bro, and it stuck. Later in life, I had thoughts about changing it. My father had since passed away. I thought about being called something else, but my mother reminded me that it was his name for me, and so I kept it.
How old were you when you lost him?
18.
How much did that unravel your world?
It was very unraveling, and it led to the single most important event of my early life, which was pursuant to a sort of coming unglued in my first year of college and a dismal sort of experience shortly after my father had died. And I joined the Army in a moment of perplexity and the desire to do something different.
Was the draft in place?
The draft was fully in place.
Did you have a number?
No, I wasn't drafted. I enlisted.
But now I realize you did just what your father had done. You left college and joined the Army.
That's right. And there were many other echoes of my father in that time. I ended up being invited to attend the Officers' Candidate School at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, where my father had also gone. And I was commissioned a second lieutenant in the artillery. My father had also done. And at the graduation ceremony, my bars were pinned on by my mother and my father's commanding officer in World War II, General Brittingham.
How long was your Vietnam experience?
It was a long 12 months, but 12 months.
Now that you have your own children, isn't it just unbelievable that at that tender age you were fighting in Vietnam or you were part of the military?
I was not only fighting, I was an officer. So I was responsible for other people and their lives. And I was 20 years old. Yeah, it's pretty startling. Very, needless to say, very strong and affecting experiences. Though I have to say that I was lucky to escape without either deep emotional wounds or physical wounds. So I was lucky.
Do you get those wounds now, though? I mean, do you understand them?
I certainly understand them, and I sympathize a great deal with veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan who have those wounds. And I think both the physical and the emotional wounds are things we don't think very much about beforehand, and we end up thinking about them a lot after. As a nation, we probably ought to think about it more at the beginning, because those wounds certainly are inevitable.
I read that that experience led you to begin thinking really hard about what it means to be human. And I'm ashamed to say that I'm not sure that I ever reflect on that myself. I should. We all should. But we're not forced to, most of us.
I think that's right. It's certainly an experience that exposes you to a fair amount of inhumanity. I think that causes you to think about all of it in a deeper and more continuous way. I had a lot of help in that, most especially when I returned and went back to college. I met up with a philosophy professor at my alma mater, Colorado College, who had written a beautiful book on his experiences in World War II called The Warriors. And that book helped me a lot, and he helped me a lot. It helped me not only understand, but I think incorporate my feelings about the experience into a narrative of my life that might not have been positive, but it was workable. It was something that, you know, I think I integrated in a certain way into who I was.
Art mentors, wonderful.
Yes, and books too, and great thinking about such things.
Tell me all the different places you ended up teaching, governing, all the different institutions and parts of the country, just to give people a feel for what experience you now bring to the chairmanship of the NEH.
I had a rich and varied academic career. I began teaching at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I went from there back to California, taught at Santa Clara University, and then ultimately at Stanford University. I was teaching at Stanford in the Great Works and Western Culture program and a little bit in the political science department as well. I went from there and changed roles quite dramatically when I was asked by a colleague at Stanford to go with him to Wesleyan University, where I became a vice president of the university. I went from there to the presidency of Bucknell University, and I went there from the presidency to the presidency of Colby College, where I was for 14 years.
Colby's in Maine?
Colby's in Waterville, Maine.
You have ancestors or family members who lived in Maine.
I did and do. The Adams family has a branch. My branch went to Maine in 1760 or so, settled in the Falmouth area. My father was born in Augusta, Maine. My grandfather was born in Portland, Maine.
Are you related to John Adams?
I am, in a somewhat less direct way.
Your Adams grandfather, I read, delightfully did not have coffee each morning, but you saw him drinking?
Clam juice, which was bracing, I'm sure.
Hot clam juice?
Hot clam juice, every morning.
After which he would say what?
I don't recall him saying anything in particular, but he was devoted to this, and he was a real Maine, he was a salty Maine guy. Loved being around him. He lived in an old house in New England in those days when I spent time with him, and had a barn that was attached to the house like many New England houses, and his wife did not permit him to watch television or to drink in the house. So he would repair to the barn, and when I was there with him, we would watch the New York Giants play football in the barn next to a big hot potbelly stove. He got one channel, and he kept a little bottle of bourbon under his chair and would periodically take a nip.
And offer you one?
Actually, yes, he did offer me one from time to time. That's nothing I've ever admitted to publicly, but he did.
How wonderful.
Yeah, it's a great memory. It's a great memory I have.
You had those experiences not because you were growing up in Maine, but you went to a prep school.
I did. The Holderness School in Plymouth, New Hampshire. About a two-hour drive from where he lived in Maine. So he would come over and gather me up at Thanksgiving and other brief holidays. And we'd go to Maine and sit in the barn and watch TV.
So where, with all of this rich and varied background you had, from combat zone to the rarefied atmosphere of elite colleges and prep schools, do you come from as president? Do you think a lot of it is sort of summed up in your initiative called the Common Good?
Much of what I've thought and cared about in the humanities is present in that initiative, whose purpose is to join humanities scholars and organizations to what I have been calling grand challenges in public life. The founding legislation of NEH calls for the agency to attend to the circumstances of contemporary life. I really like that phrase. And so I began thinking almost right away about how I could encourage humanities scholars and organizations to take that sort of public-facing approach to their work and to thereby contribute to the common good, to the betterment of the country.
Aren't they all already doing that?
Well, some are. I think in some ways, however, that over the last several decades, I think humanities scholars, particularly on the academic side of things, have been drawn into a much more technical and professional and inward-facing exercise of the humanities. Specialization became the coinage of the realm in many ways. Now, that's true in other places, too. The natural sciences, there are certainly places where specialization has become necessary. But in the humanities, it caused, I think, a turning away from or a letting alone of these deeply important human issues that we all wrestle with personally and as members of the public world that need the forms of understanding and knowledge that the humanities offer.
Give me examples.
Well, almost every demanding issue that we face as a people is not a problem that can be resolved by the application of technology. There are issues that deal with our values, our ideas, our history, and our culture. Those are the areas in which the humanities work, and those are the areas in which most of our very significant public challenges, and I would offer personal challenges also, emerge. And so we need the forms of understanding and knowledge that the humanities provide to engage those areas of our lives. And encouraging humanities scholars and organizations to do that is one of the principal things I'm interested in doing at any age.
Have you already funded some of these efforts?
We are just beginning to understand the ways in which we might fund them. We just announced a new program in the research division called the Public Scholar Program, which is an encouragement to humanities scholars, both in the academic world and independent scholars, to turn their work in a more public-facing way, that is to say, to speak to broader audiences. I think we're going to get some very interesting proposals.
As the very new chairman of an organization just about to celebrate its 50th year, when was NEH founded?
NEH was founded on September 29th, 1965, to be precise, and that was the day that Lyndon Johnson signed the legislation creating both the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities, a wonderful piece of legislation and of a piece with the other extraordinary legislative moments of that time. The Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. It was a tumultuous decade in so many ways. But in the midst of all this tumult, this enormously creative period, and NEH is a product of that period. We have $4.8 billion in grants made to individuals and organizations over that period of time, 7,000 grants to individual scholars, to colleges and universities, libraries, museums, historical societies. It's a brilliant and very important story.
Have you begun talking one-on-one with senators and congresspeople?
I have. I've met with most of our appropriators, both on the Senate and House side, and I will finish the rounds soon as the new Congress takes shape.
And you find friends of the humanities on both sides of the aisle?
Yes, I do. One of the most aisle crossing is, of course, this whole question of historical and cultural legacy in the United States. Without the humanities, there is no cultural and historical legacy in the country. And without the focused attention of NEH, there is no consistent application of the humanities to those issues, because only we are charged exclusively with preserving that legacy. No other foundation is. No other individual is. We are. And we do.
I thought the battlefield preservation societies preserved battlefields and libraries preserve what they preserve. What are you doing?
Our giving goes to many of those kinds of organizations. And we support many, many different important historical landmark sites. And we support many different associations and organizations that are involved with those sites. We gave the sort of the stimulating grant to James Madison's wonderful home and complex at Montpelier, and many grants have followed in the wake of that. We were Ken Burns' first funder in his film on the Brooklyn Bridge. Ken is pleased to say, and I've heard him say it, no NEH, no Ken Burns, because we were there at the start, as we are with many of these organizations and projects. My belief is that the common good, the good of this country, can't be approached or understood without the work of the humanities, our history, with our culture, our values, and our ideas. All of that is bound up in a very, very tight way with the humanities. And we need to nourish those humanistic ways of thinking and understanding the world in order to have those strong legacies survive.
Well, Bro Adams, good luck to you, and thank you for sharing your insights.
Thank you.
Bro Adams is chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Prior to that, he served as president of Colby College for 14 years. Coming up next, how Gettysburg park rangers considered melting down monuments to help the war effort in the 1940s. Perhaps the most famous battle to take place on American soil, the Battle of Gettysburg, has been written about, recreated, and mythologized extensively. But little is told about what happened to the battlefield itself after the fighting stopped. Jennifer Murray is a professor at the University of Virginia's College at Wise, and she's published a new book on the subject called On a Great Battlefield, The Making, Management, and Memory of Gettysburg National Military Park, 1933 through 2013. Jennifer, Gettysburg is called the bloodiest battle of the Civil War. How so?
Well, it's the bloodiest battle of the Civil War. It resulted in 51,000 Union and Confederate soldiers casualties over the 3 days of fighting. The Army of Northern Virginia, Robert E. Lee's army, had about 70,000 men that he brought into Pennsylvania, and he loses about 28,000 of them. So that's pretty close to a third of his army that's lost in Gettysburg in 3 days of fighting. By 1863 July, the American Civil War is entering its third year. And for most part on the Eastern Theater, Robert E. Lee and the Army of Northern Virginia has been victorious. Every time they engage the Union Army, the Confederates are winning. But they're unable to win a decisive victory. So in the summer of 1863, after the Battle of Chancellorsville, which is an overwhelming Confederate victory, Robert E. Lee will make the decision to take his Confederate army north. And he leaves Virginia, crosses over the Potomac River in what he believes will be the decisive battle of the American Civil War. On the other hand, the Union Army is very much demoralized, losing battle after battle, and they've completely lost faith in their commander. Abraham Lincoln will replace the Union commander who lost that horrific battle at Chancellorsville, which was Joseph Hooker, with George Gordon Meade. And Meade's objective is to keep between the Confederate Army and Washington, D.C. And on July the 1st, these two armies will clash at Gettysburg on the morning of July the 1st.
How did the battle rage?
Well, the battle begins as an accident. Neither Meade nor Lee actually wanted to fight in Gettysburg. It begins as an accident. The first shot of the battle is fired about 8 o'clock in the morning, and the battle proceeds through the morning of July the 1st and into the afternoon, and the Confederates are pushing the Union forces through the town. And on the first day, the South wins. And then the ensuing second and third day is Robert E. Lee suffers horrific casualties. And on July the 3rd, Lee's belief is that the Union center is the weak point, which is Cemetery Ridge, and he will take 13,000 Confederate soldiers and launch a massive frontal assault towards the center of the Union line, which will be termed Pickett's Charge. It's the iconic moment of the Battle of Gettysburg. And Pickett's Charge is unsuccessful. The Confederates will lose about 50% of the men that are engaged. And Robert E. Lee will make the decision to withdraw, and he begins to take the remnants of the shattered Army of Northern Virginia out of Gettysburg and back across the Potomac River into Virginia.
What miscalculation had he made when he had beaten them battle after battle?
That's a great question. We tend to put Lee up on a pedestal as this great strategic thinker. And up until he engaged Meade at Gettysburg in July of 1863, every time the Army of Northern Virginia engaged the Union Army, they had been victorious. So Lee has every reason to believe that his gambles and his bold offensives will prove fruitful yet again in Gettysburg. And Lee writes a really interesting letter to one of his subordinate commanders, and he says that he believes his men are invincible. Invincible. So he has every reason to believe that his men are in fact invincible, and he can do anything that he asks them to do, and they'll win. And they'll win again in Gettysburg in July of 1863.
So how do you lose tens of thousands of men to a battlefield on each side and then clean up in the aftermath?
That's a long process, and both the Union and Confederate armies make efforts to bury their dead, but a lot of times the aftermath and the cleanup process would fall to the civilians, and the civilians would take part in burying the Union and Confederate soldiers and caring for the wounded, and they would find this just horrific maelstrom of destruction just permeated their lives for years after these two armies had fled.
When did Gettysburg Battlefield become a monument?
The initial preservation efforts are done right after the battle. And the Battle of Gettysburg is in July 1863. Lincoln delivers the Gettysburg Address 4 months later. And local civilians have already started to preserve landscape features. And in April 1864, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania charters what is called the Gettysburg Battlefield Memorial Association.
It's hard to believe that within a year or so of a battle like that, people would try to buy up land to preserve it. Why?
Well, right away, people both in Gettysburg, in Adams County, Pennsylvania, and across the nation recognized how important the Battle of Gettysburg was.
Right.
And on July 4th, 1863, so one day after the repulse of Pickett's Charge, the Philadelphia Inquirer's headlines, the banner headlines, said, "Waterloo eclipsed." So you can imagine the euphoria and the joy that Northern civilians felt when they heard that the Army of the Potomac had finally beaten Robert E. Lee, this seemingly invincible Confederate army.
Right.
And they've repulsed him from Pennsylvania, and he's going back across the Potomac River. And they identified Gettysburg as a Waterloo, this decisive battle in the American Civil War that turns the future and the fate of all subsequent battles to be fought. So with that in mind, they start to preserve the land of this Waterloo victory of the Army of the Potomac.
And then another striking feature of the Gettysburg battlefield is it's rife with monuments.
Yeah, Gettysburg is the most commemorated and monumented of the Civil War battlefields. There's over 1,300 monuments and markers, the overwhelming majority of them which are put up by the veterans themselves in the 1880s and 1890s during the surge of commemoration that follows near the 25th anniversary of the American Civil War.
Are they mostly Northern monuments?
Overwhelmingly, they're Northern monuments. Southerners don't have an interest in commemorating and memorializing the battlefield until the 1960s, the Civil War centennial.
Your book looks at a history of the battlefield itself. Why do you start mostly at 1933?
The Battle of Gettysburg, there are over 6,000 books on the Battle of Gettysburg. But moving forward into the 20th century, very few historians and scholars have paid any attention to what the battlefield means to 20th century Americans. The National Park Service acquires the battlefield right at the beginning of the Great Depression. And they utilize Gettysburg as a make-work opportunity. The federal government authorizes two civilian conservation corps camps at Gettysburg. And what's unique about the CCC camps at Gettysburg is that they are African-American laborers. Not only were they black workers, but they were also black supervisors.
Do you think it was deliberate to use the site of this great speech by Abraham Lincoln on race to house African Americans workers there?
Yes. Gettysburg is deliberately picked as the first camp to have black officers for that reason. During the 1960s, with this simultaneous occurrence of the Civil War centennial and the Civil Rights Movement, you'll have Northern politicians and Southern politicians coming back to the battlefield in July 1963, rededicating monuments and speaking about racial harmony, and they're urging the end of racial discord, presenting a unified front in the face of communism, and urging this end to this volatility of race relations in the 1960s.
Was it the bloody Battle of Gettysburg, or really Abraham Lincoln's address there, that gives Gettysburg a racial and political significance over other Civil War battlefields?
What makes Gettysburg unique above any other Civil War battlefield is Lincoln. And Lincoln's delivering of the Gettysburg Address in November 1963 defined the Battle of Gettysburg and the American Civil War.
You write that during World War II, President Roosevelt actually said, "We are the arsenal of democracy." And he called upon the National Park Service to comb through the parks just looking for materials that might be scrapped if they were needed.
Yeah, the National Park Service at Gettysburg will donate over 18 tons of scrap metal. But the most radical of the scrap drive was a proposal to basically disassemble the park's commemorative features, namely the monuments.
Really?
And which is
they're going to melt down the monuments.
They would have melt down the monuments, and that proposal goes through all the monuments on the battlefield, and it prioritizes them into 9 different groups. The first group is the first to go, and the 9th group will be the last to go if the war's demands reach the point that they need to scrap and melt down the monuments.
So which would have been considered the most precious and which the most expendable?
Very good question, and very ironic. The 9th category, which is the most precious, are the Confederate monuments that stood on the battlefield in the 1940s.
That's surprising from a northern government.
Well, it was the Alabama Monument, the North Carolina Monument, and the Virginia Monument. They felt that the artistic merit of all 3 of those monuments warranted last on the scrapping.
It's so ironic. You write that the eternal flame that was established at Gettysburg was the inspiration for the one that later graced the grave of John F. Kennedy.
Yeah, 1963 is the centennial of the Battle of Gettysburg, and John F. Kennedy and his wife, Jackie Kennedy, will visit the Gettysburg battlefield that spring. And reportedly, John Kennedy was so impressed with the monument and the eternal flame, and Jackie Kennedy has this memory of which they visited the Gettysburg battlefield, and her husband was so impressed with the eternal flame on the eternal monument that she chose to place that for him on his grave at Arlington.
Jennifer Murray is a professor of history at the University of Virginia's College at Wise. Her new book is On a Great Battlefield, The Making, Management, and Memory of Gettysburg National Military Park. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. I'm Sarah McConnell. Welcome back. Allen Ginsberg was the poet laureate of the 1950s Beat Generation. A decade later, he became an articulate champion for the counterculture movement in the 1960s. This brief exchange in 1968 between Ginsberg and conservative talk show host William F. Buckley on Buckley's show Firing Line captures the mood of the era.
Mr. Allen Ginsberg is perhaps the most famous and admired contemporary American poet. But he is known here in America less as a poet than a prophet, the hippie's hippie, the bohemian prototype. I should like to begin by asking Mr. Ginsberg whether he considers that the hippies are an intimation of the new order.
Hippies is kind of a stereotype.
Yeah.
Generally a newspaper stereotype. To the extent that what is called the hippie movement involves an alteration of consciousness towards some greater awareness and greater individuality, which you might even sympathize with,
yeah.
Then hopefully the future will see like a spread of that gentleness and consideration coming through.
It was around this time that Allen Ginsberg bought a farm in New York to serve as what he called a haven for comrades in distress. Gordon Ball was the farm manager from 1968 to 71. He's written a book about his experience called East Hill Farm, Seasons with Allen Ginsberg. Gordon Ball also teaches a course on Ginsberg and the Beat Generation to young cadets at Virginia Military Institute. Gordon, tell me about East Hill Farm and Allen Ginsberg's notion of it as a haven for distressed poets.
Mm-hmm. Some years earlier, Allen, when he began making some money from his poetry, took an informal vow of penury to take only the money he needed to support himself and his partner, Peter Orlovsky, and give the rest away to others whose work he admired and help them get by. Allen had had some thoughts about getting something out in the country, and Barbara Rubin, who was a young lady friend of Allen's in those days, had become taken with the idea, and she brought all of us together on the farm, which she basically got and nudged and budged Allen into getting.
Ginsberg funded this farm through an organization he created called the Committee on Poetry. Was this just a way to fund East Hill Farm, or did it support distressed poets in other ways also?
No, he had set it up earlier to support colleagues in the arts like Mary Baraka, Leroy Jones, Andrei Kudrescu, Harry Smith, the filmmaker, and Peter Orlovsky was Allen's longtime partner. William Carlos Williams made a survey of young poets of the day in the late 50s and declared Peter Orlovsky the best lyric poet of his generation. So Peter was with Allen for many years, and a lot of trouble when he would go manic on amphetamine and take things out on everybody else, even once greeting Allen by hurrying up the driveway, swinging a machete over his head.
Were these poets who were hooked on drugs?
Oh, some were, and that was the problem, is that many of them were involved in the street scene in New York, scoring for needle drugs, and that's why the move to the country, where needle drugs were forbidden and where they would be far from their connections.
There are fascinating letters you include in there where marvelous people make mm-hmm. abject appeals for money mm-hmm. to their good old pal, mm-hmm. Allen Ginsberg.
So here's one from a lady friend of Allen's. From East Pakistan. Allen, I love you. 3 months, no money. Your 3 letters received, but no dollars. Please help. Care of U.S. Consul, Dhaka. A letter from a very interesting person who was a friend, Herbert Hunke, who once declared himself the mayor of Times Square, when Times Square was a very different affair from the Disney confection that it has become in recent decades. It was Hunke who introduced Ginsberg and Kerouac to the underworld there in Times Square in the 40s. And so here's a letter from Hunke in San Francisco to Allen in the summer of 68, shortly before Hunke arrives at the farm. I'm extremely anxious to get in touch with you. So far, I'm doing unusually well, holding out against getting hooked, although I've gotten off several times since returning to the city. Perhaps, it will sound phony, but I am more anxious than ever not to end up with a habit. Allen, please don't delay getting in touch with me any longer than is absolutely necessary. Meanwhile, I love you and need you.
No dollar figure on either one of these.
Well, not demanding.
Right. And Allen generally came through?
Oh, yes, he did. He generally did again and again.
So at East Hill Farm in the early days, you were there. Allen was there on and off.
That's right, because he had to go out and give readings to support the farm. The buildings were dilapidated. No running water until we put a primitive system in ourselves, and no electricity ever. And getting 10 feet of snow during the year.
You were the farm manager, you defaulted into that position
at least.
A lot fell on you.
Yeah.
How did you come to have this ringside seat and more with these founders of the Beat Generation?
Well, I was friends with Barbara Rubin. My lady friend Candy and I were friends with Barbara Rubin, who was Allen's lady friend in those days. And it was her idea that Candy and I would be caretakers there.
But before that, you and Candy, the book opens with you emerging from 2 weeks in a Mexican jail.
Right.
How old were you then?
I was 23.
23. What had happened?
Oh, well, Candy and I had left New York for Mexico and had ended up in Jalapa, which was a tiny village on the coast we'd stayed there for several months and decided to move deeper into the jungle, to make a go of it and forsake civilization altogether. So Enrique and I left one day for the little ferry for the two-hour trip to the nearest town. When we got off the boat soon afterwards, we were arrested. It was simply the day that the federales had scheduled for a roundup of gringo hippies. This was March of 1968. And so we were kept in the jail for a couple of weeks and then sent to the Office of Immigration for interrogation in Mexico City, and then deported the next day back to the U.S.
Was it scary?
Yeah, sure, it was scary because you didn't know what was happening. I mean, I felt really good at first entering the jail and seeing friends who had just arrived on the same little ferry. And, you know, I felt almost sort of triumphant. I know that may sound strange, but I felt we were together. But then we didn't know what was going to happen. And women were arrested. They were, Candy and others, they were kept in the cop's office. We were outdoors in the courtyard. And we would keep hearing rumors every day. We didn't know what was going to happen next. One was the mayor wanted to move us all out to the stadium and be supervised by the army. Charles Collingwood, CBS reporter, was in town, and somebody said, "Don't you want to do something about your fellow Americans in jail?" And he said, "You don't expect me to care about those people," we were told, he said.
I'm reminded of how polarized we were as a nation, as people. Mm-hmm. This crazy polarization between the youth movement mm-hmm. and everyone else.
Yeah, we thought it was reflected in the arrest, in that Mexico wanted to, so to speak, clean itself up before the Olympics that were coming in that fall in Mexico City. And also we were told things like American tourists, having worked hard and saved all their lives, get a Mexican vacation, and then they come down and see these young, long-haired people walking around freely having a good time in Mexico. And they thought that those were the people they'd tried to leave behind in the States. That was part of what was then called the generation gap.
It's so interesting. Everyone has a story of how they arrived, where they were in the late 60s. In your case, you led also a very sheltered, privileged life. You were born in New Jersey, but from age 5 on, you grew up in Tokyo with a family of some means.
Well, yeah, as part of the foreign business community, my father worked for what is now Citigroup, then National City Bank.
Did you know you were a bohemian when you headed into New York City? Did you think,
see myself that way. I mean, I had long hair. That was a big deal. You know, some longish hair. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't terribly long. I felt so elated walking the streets of Greenwich Village, seeing black and white together, music pouring from the streets. That was sort of wonderful. And likewise, going to the Newport Folk Festival, seeing Joan Baez dancing with blacks on stage, feeling like I was with a whole different company of people.
There's a section in your book where you write about your hopes.
Yes, indeed. This is from, I'd like to read two paragraphs from an early chapter, On to the Farm. It was time to get to Cherry Valley, and while the notion of cutting urban ties and setting off for a rural retreat with vivid, dynamic young women and one of the great poets of the age was exciting, the circumstances that we eventually faced, including 10 feet of snow, schizophrenia, paranoia, and dozens of separate egos all fighting for their moment in Allen's sun, were another matter. Could we make a go of it in such a setting? I wondered, I worried, we all did. A communal establishment not in New York City, but at the state's heart, headed by one of the most notorious figures in American culture of the day, an outspoken opponent of the Vietnam War, when to be such was considered un-American by many, a homosexual, a celebrant of homosexuality, of sexuality itself, when the very word sex was still uttered with a hush in homes across America. Not merely a user, but an advocate of marijuana and psychedelics, when prevailing opinion confused marijuana and heroin. A bearded, long-haired grown-up who unabashedly expressed sympathy for the emerging youth culture as police stepped up violence in the name of law enforcement. Would we survive?
What a great encapsulation of the times. Absolutely.
Thank you.
When you look back on the person you were at East Hill Farm, who was that person, and how has your life been affected by that experience, would you say?
Well, a younger than most 23 to 25-year-old, kind of dreamy, but curious and intrigued by Alan and others, and fascinated even by Alan and Peter both.
Gordon Ball is a professor of English at Virginia Military Institute. His latest book is East Hill Farm, Seasons with Allen Ginsberg. Coming up next, The Original Beat. He's little known now, but in the 1950s, a drug-addicted street hustler and petty thief named Herbert Hunky was a friend and an inspiration to the great beat authors like Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, and William Burroughs. And his character appears in the writings of all three. My next guest is Hillary Holliday, who's written a book about Hunky called American Hipster, The Life of Herbert Hunky, the Times Square Hustler Who Inspired the Beat Movement. Hillary, Herbert Hunky was such a debauched character, part of the beat generation, and yet he fascinated the great beat characters of the period.
Well, Sarah, yes, he was a debauched figure, but he was extraordinarily complicated and had so many different sides to him. He was humorous, he was tender, he was pumped up on drugs, he was pumped up on love, pumped up on life, and when it came time for me to start thinking as a beat scholar which of these writers I might want to write about, he was completely irresistible. And so maybe I could read from the beginning of my book so you can find out a little bit about what I discovered as I did my research. One summer day in 1927, a rebellious 12-year-old boy climbed aboard a Chicago trolley car. Although his mother had given him a dime and dispatched him to his father's apartment, he had no intention of going there. He wanted to leave both of his troublesome parents behind and see a little bit of the world. His first destination was his birthplace of Greenfield, Massachusetts. His second was New York City. Decades later, he said of his youthful journey, "I felt so free and light. All my shackles were suddenly dropped. I didn't want to see anybody I knew ever again." Herbert Hunky, who would provide Jack Kerouac with the word beat and show up in works by all of the primary beat authors, was on the road. I'll just read you just a little more here. Hunky never traveled long or far without attracting the notice of the law. But unlike Kerouac, who painted police officers as buffoons, or William Burroughs, who saw them as a perverted outgrowth of a corrupt system, or Allen Ginsberg, who fed off the vigorous opposition they provided to his iconoclastic way of thinking, Hunky saw policemen as fellow street people who just happened to wield more power than he ever would. He would also listen to them and respond. Even as a child, he knew how to have a real conversation, and he considered conversation the essence of human contact.
And that's true. I think sometimes there is a sort of emotional dance between street people and police officers, and I could imagine they would have loved him.
Yeah, I think, I wanted to start the book with that anecdote because it shows so much about Hunky. It shows him wanting to travel to explore the world at such a young age. It also shows a young criminal in the making. You know, imagine getting in trouble with the law at that early an age.
He was 12, right?
Yeah. I mean, he was just a kid, and he got so far. He got all the way to New York State from Chicago.
Can you put your finger on just what was so bad about his home life?
I think what was so bad was that Herbert didn't see enough love. I think there was love in that household, but unfortunately, he saw the flip side of it. He heard the yelling and screaming. He saw the tensions between parents who had married when they were probably too young to get married. And yet, he was able to love. And I think the fact that he was able to love had to have some roots in his early childhood.
Before we get into what is fascinating about him, will you indulge me and just give me the litany of horrific things about his life that would scare off a lot of people?
Well, Herbert Hunke, a little bit of bio on him, was born in 1915 to basically middle-class parents, and he got into drugs at a young age. He dropped out of school. He traveled all around the country, meeting all sorts of rough characters. The drug use continued. To that, he added theft, burglary, and prostitution. He then moved to New York City in 1939 and embarked on a career as a hustler and a burglar, and somewhere in there managed to meet some very important people, people who would become important, and that is Allen Ginsberg, Jack Kerouac, and William Burroughs.
So was he really a kind of shadow character who fascinated them, but otherwise was not a great writer?
I think he was a wonderful writer. I really do. And Kerouac actually described Hunke as a genius of a storyteller. Ginsberg saw the humanity, the suffering humanity in Hunke, and as a young apprentice poet, wanted Hunke to read his own poems and respond to them. But then there was something else about him, and that special something else was that Hunke was a marvelous storyteller with a mesmerizing voice.
I didn't realize until reading your book that he is the one who actually gave rise to the term beat in Beat Generation.
He did. Hunke had an amazing vocabulary of street slang. And one of the words he used, of course, was beat. He would say, oh, I'm beat, man. I'm beat down to my socks. Kerouac was a sponge for interesting language. And he picked up that word, which I'm sure he would have heard from others as well, but Hunke had so much panache that it carried a special resonance when he used it.
And even though he later said, well, Beat Generation means empathetic or whatever, what do you think he knew right then it also meant, that it was the downtrodden?
Yeah, he was referring to the downtrodden element of his generation. He also was thinking about how people were, especially young people, after World War II. The world was full of so much promise, so many opportunities, and yet they felt like, uh-oh, do we have to follow a set path? Do we have to go to college, get married, have a house in the suburbs? Or is there something else? And so in the Beat Generation, he saw the people who felt thwarted but wanted more and hadn't given up yet on whatever that more might be.
Isn't that everybody's dilemma?
I think it really is. And he wanted to live an artistic, different sort of life. And that's what drew him together with those writers who then became famous and carried Hunke along on their coattails.
When did Kerouac and Ginsberg meet Hunke?
It all happened in the mid-1940s, and Hunke and Ginsberg developed a particularly long-lasting, vexed friendship. Ginsberg was inspired to write Howl in large part because of his friendship with Herbert Hunke, and there are lines in Howl, which is Ginsberg's long, epic poem about the Beat Generation, that clearly refer to Hunke. So Ginsberg had to go through this trial by fire where he met these down-and-out people like Hunke, took them in, knew them up close and personally, you might say, and then spent time in a mental institution. That was the necessary soil from which the great poem Howl could grow.
Did all these important writers use Hunke as sort of an abominable, an interesting character, or did they portray him as estimable?
Well, more the latter. I think because they were interested in showing people in pain, showing people who suffered, Hunke was a natural for that. And Hunke's model for them was someone who suffered, who could do some mean, dastardly things, but who also had a good heart. And I think that's what Kerouac admired in Hunky. Hunky was a thief, and he didn't mind stealing from his own friends. He wasn't a particularly successful thief, although he liked to think he was. But Hunky tried so hard to be downwardly mobile and to fail in life, and yet he couldn't help but succeed. All signals pointed towards someone who would die a complete non-entity. And instead, he somehow bubbled his way up, if not to the top, at least close enough to the surface where he could be associated with Kerouac and Ginsberg. And in many ways, he's the essence of what it is to be Bede.
Hillary Holliday, thank you for sharing your insights on this with me today on With Good Reason.
Thank you, Sarah. It's a pleasure to be here.
Hillary Holliday is the author of American Hipster, The Life of Herbert Hunky, the Times Square hustler who inspired the Beat Movement. Major support for With Good Reason is provided by an anonymous donor and by Bill and Allison Freeling. We also welcome support from the law firm of McGuire Woods. With Good Reason is produced by the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Elliot Majerzik, Kelly Libby, and Allison Quance are our associate producers. Our assistant producer is Lilia Fukin. Andrew Windham is our executive producer, and Jeannie Palin handles listener services. Visit us at withgoodreasonradio.org or download the podcast on iTunes. For a free copy of the show mailed to you on a CD, call 877-451-5098. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.